This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, June 7th, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up in Syria, details emerge of a massacre in a village in Hama as the UN warns of the possibility of an all-out civil war. A review of the Obama administration's immigration policy finds not much has changed as detentions and deportations continue. And as groups in New Jersey file a legal challenge against the NYPD's surveillance of Muslims, we'll go to San Francisco, where a new law seeks to balance civil liberties with police and FBI anti-terrorism efforts. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. A NATO airstrike has reportedly left at least 18 people dead in Afghanistan's Logar province. Afghan officials say some or possibly all of the victims were civilians, including women and children, attending a wedding party. An AP photo of the scene shows people digging through the rubble of a collapsed building. NATO says it has launched an investigation into the incident. In addition, a string of suicide bomb attacks claimed by the Taliban left 22 civilians dead yesterday near a NATO military base in Kandahar province. Activists involved in the ongoing student strike in Montreal are facing police raids and arrests today ahead of the start of festivities for the Formula One Grand Prix car race. FSRN's Aaron Lakoff has the story.
Montreal police showed up at the homes of 11 activists early this morning and made arrests. Among those detained was the daughter of prominent left-wing Quebec politician Amir Kadir. Yelda Kadir is being accused of mischief in connection with a student demonstration at the office of a former education minister in April. The arrest comes 2 days after Amir himself was arrested in Quebec City after having taken part in a peaceful casserole march. These casserole marches, characterized by thousands of people banging on pots and pans, have become a nightly phenomenon across Quebec over the last few weeks. These protests are just the beginning of what could be a tense summer in Montreal. Students and activist groups are targeting many of the city's outdoor festivals with the hopes of putting economic pressure on the Quebec government. A recent report in the National Post newspaper revealed that Montreal's tourism industry lost $6 million in the month of May alone. Aaron Lakoff, FSRN, Montreal.
A prolonged heat wave sweeping across the eastern parts of India has claimed more than 200 lives over the past 4 days. In some places, the temperature has reached 118 degrees. Aside from the deaths, thousands of acres of crops have been destroyed by the heat, bringing the possibility of a food crisis later this year. Prabhakar Mani Tiwari reports from West Bengal, where the effects of the heat wave have been most devastating.
The state of West Bengal is experiencing the hottest summer in 2 decades. Scores of peoples are dying due to a dearth of healthcare facilities. In rural areas, lack of awareness and infrastructure have caused the death toll to rise. Today, the government took stock of the situation, cancelling leave time for local health department officials so they are available to deal with rising number of patients. In past years, 3 to 4 days of high temperatures have been followed by a cooling rain. But this year, the heat wave has lasted about 2 weeks. Meteorologists predict the situation to turn worse over the weekend. The ongoing heat wave is unlikely to subside until the monsoon begins in mid-June. Prabhakar Mani Tiwari, FSRN, Kolkata.
Lawmakers in Denmark today voted to require the state's Lutheran Church to perform full and formal same-sex marriage ceremonies. Previously, the church only allowed gay couples blessing ceremonies outside of regular church services. The new law passed the parliament by a large margin, with more than 3/4 of MPs voting in favor. It will take effect next week. The U.S. Defense of Marriage Act has suffered yet another blow, as a federal district court judge in New York found it to be discriminatory. The case focused on a tax issue where a woman was not allowed to claim a spousal exemption on estate taxes from her deceased wife. The judge ordered Wednesday that the $350,000 paid to the federal government by the plaintiff be returned. This is the fifth time a judge has found DOMA to be unconstitutional, according to Reuters. The military's health care policy forbids federal funds from being spent on abortion services for women soldiers, except in cases where the woman's life is in danger, even though other federal employees can receive federally subsidized abortions in cases of rape and incest. Today, New Hampshire Democrat Jean Shaheen pushed for the passage of her amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act, which would extend that right to servicewomen. FSRN's Neth Smith-Savidoff reports from D.C.
The 1976 Hyde Amendment limited the use of federal money for abortion services to cases of rape, incest, and where the woman's life is in danger. But further limits were added for servicewomen in 1979, eliminating the rape and incest provisions. Senator Jean Shaheen said her amendment would at least make things consistent. Retired U.S. Army General Gail Pollack joined Shaheen on Capitol Hill Thursday to support the amendment.
It makes me incredibly angry to know that after a sexual assault, our servicewomen, the wives, the daughters, who each serve and sacrifice for our country, lack the same insurance coverage that other women in America enjoy.
This amendment comes at a time when new investigations are shining light on widespread sexual assault in the military. The Shaheen Amendment was added to the Senate's version of the National Defense Authorization Act of 2013, which has not yet come to the floor for a vote. Nesmith Savadoff, FSRN, Washington.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. The United Nations said today that observers trying to reach the site of a massacre in Syria were blocked by the army at checkpoints. General Robert Mood, head of the UN supervision mission in Syria, said monitors will continue to try to enter the village of Masrat al-Kubir to confirm facts on the ground. According to activists with the local coordination committees, an assault Wednesday killed more than 78 civilians in the village. Video purportedly of the victims posted online shows rows of dead children and women and black charred bodies. In an interview posted to YouTube by Syrian translators, a man who spoke from the village said he witnessed the aftermath of the killings.
I swear by God, there was a three-month-old infant who was burnt alive. They were all burnt by fire. Assad's thugs burned houses and burnt them down. Families were slaughtered and burnt too.
UN Special Envoy Kofi Annan addressed the UN today, describing deteriorating conditions in the country and warning of an all-out civil war. For more, we're joined by Radwan Ziadeh, director of the Damascus Center for Human Rights and a member of the Syrian National Council. He joins us on the line from Washington, D.C. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you for having me.
Some members of your organization have met with victims and relatives and survivors of this massacre. What are they telling you about what happened in the village?
What's happened is it's the same scenario we had before in Hawla, where the Assad army start shelling the area. With that, then the people, they are running from place to place. Then two trucks with the full of Sheikh Bihameen, they get inside the village, and they are searching from house to house. They open the fire and slaughter some of the children there. And at least 86 has been killed. 35 from one family, and half of them, they are children and men.
Among the names that your organization has confirmed among the dead are a 4-year-old child, a 9-year-old child, 5-year-old child, a 1-year-old infant. Talk about the toll on children of this latest massacre.
Yeah, we have this. The youngest children is three months old. And I think this is tragedy. How we can allow this to happen again after Al-Hawla? I think the images and the videos we got every time on this massacres, it's discovered of any human, which anyone can cannot see and watch all these videos and pictures.
You described some of the circumstances of this latest, these latest killings, which appear to share some similarities with Al-Hula. That's when more than 100 civilians were killed. And in that one as well, witnesses described the Shabiha, or paramilitary groups, going from house to house and targeting civilians and killing them execution style. What is the role of Shabiha in this massacre as well?
The Shabiha, most of the Shabiha, they are coming from the sectarian background. And let's be clear that those, they got the full support of the security forces and the Assad militias. Because in Al-Hawla, as example, between the Al-Qabu, where most of the Shabihas, they belong to this village, and the Tildo, the village that the massacres occurred, there are only 1,500 meters, but there are 3 security and army checkpoints, and they cannot cross this security and checkpoints without getting the permission of the support from the Syrian army and the Syrian security forces. And this is why it's clear right now that the Assad militias or the Shabiha, they got the full support from the army and from the Assad regime, and the Assad himself. It should be held responsible and accountable for the crimes against humanity.
Secretary of State Clinton stepped up her calls for Assad to step down in comments today. UN envoy Kofi Annan addressed the UN today as well on the peace plan moving forward. You are also a member of the Syrian National Council. What are you calling for from the international community, and how would you work to end violence if Assad were to step down?
Again, and adopt a stronger resolution under Charter 7. We'll have a transitional government which will be responsible in governing Syria and on the transition and organizing free and fair elections. We know the transition will be difficult, but at least this is the only way for Syria to move forward.
Professor Ziadeh, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Radwan Ziadeh is director of the Damascus Center for Human Rights. He's also a member of the Syrian National Council. Immigrants' rights activists are occupying President Obama's campaign office in Denver and waging a hunger strike. They say they won't leave until the president signs an executive order to stop deporting youth who are eligible under the DREAM Act, proposed legislation that offers a path to citizenship for some undocumented youth. The protest comes as a just-completed review of the administration's massive deportation backlog finds that far fewer low-priority cases have been dismissed than advocates had hoped, and thousands continue to be detained and deported. FSRN's Alice Olstein has more in Washington, D.C.
Director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement John Morton ordered his agents last summer to begin sifting through the massive list of individuals under deportation proceedings and exercise discretion where immigrants had strong family ties and no criminal records. The memo especially urged the agency to deprioritize cases against undocumented students and minors. But after completing the review this week, the agency had closed or dismissed just 1% of the more than 400,000 pending deportation cases. And even when cases are dismissed, undocumented individuals remain in a legal limbo, unable to work or receive financial aid for college. President Obama has said this kind of case-by-case review is all he can do for undocumented youth until Congress passes the DREAM Act, which provides a path to citizenship for students who were brought to this country as children and who fulfill certain requirements like joining the military or going to college. But immigration law professor Andrew Schoenholtz at Georgetown University says the president can do more with or without Congress.
The executive branch has always had and has used a variety of powers to determine when to and when not to prosecute deportation cases.
Schoenholtz recently joined nearly 100 immigration law professors from across the country in signing a letter to President Obama outlining the legal tools he could use to make sure dreamers, mixed-status families, and other low-risk groups aren't targeted by immigration agents. The letter says an executive order would make sure such people aren't put in deportation proceedings in the first place. Schoenholtz says this would be more humane and efficient than yet another agency memo to review cases that have already begun.
So far, the evidence doesn't suggest that the exercise has proven significant enough both to identify the cases that should and shouldn't be prioritized and to make the immigration removal adjudication system, the immigration courts, a better functioning system. There's no reason for the taxpayers to be spending lots of money for judges, for trial attorneys, for interpreters in cases that don't need to be prosecuted because they're not priorities.
More than 1 million people have been deported since President Obama took office in 2009, though he continues to call for the passage of the DREAM Act and promises to tackle comprehensive immigration reform if reelected. Frustrated with the lack of progress, immigrants' rights activists across the country launched a campaign of nonviolent direct action this month to push the administration to act with greater urgency. A group of undocumented students and their supporters brought a petition to the Obama campaign office in Denver, Colorado, Tuesday night, demanding the president sign an executive order to stop deporting DREAM Act-eligible students. When the staff refused a meeting, the protesters began a sit-in and hunger strike in the office. Undocumented student Javier Hernandez spent Wednesday night locked in with several other activists and continued his vigil Thursday.
We're on hunger strike. We're putting our health at risk for our community. We want an executive order because these are the offices that are trying to get the vote out, you know, that are trying to win over our Latino community. Yet we know the facts, and the facts are that under President Obama, our community has been deported in record numbers.
Hernandez, who says he was brought to the U.S. as an infant, has now gone without food for over 3 days. Speaking to Avasaran from inside the Denver Obama office, he said he was willing to risk deportation to send a strong message to the president.
We're wondering, where do you really stand with our community? You know, and that's what we're saying. If you want our Latino vote, then you're going to have to give us something, right? And that what we're asking for is an executive order that will end deportation of Dreamers.
Hernandez says President Obama has until June 13th to respond to their demands, or DREAM activists will take over his reelection campaign offices in 15 other states. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
In New Jersey, Muslim students, religious and business leaders have filed a lawsuit against the New York Police Department to end its surveillance program of Muslim communities in the area. According to investigations by the Associated Press, the police department infiltrated dozens of mosques and student groups and kept individuals under surveillance. The suit filed Wednesday by the group Muslim Advocates calls the practice unconstitutional and discriminatory and seeks an end to spying and the deletion of files that the NYPD holds. Imam W. Dean Sharif is convener of the Council of Imams of New Jersey and one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit.
To find out that the New York Police Department actually took photographs of our mothers, our children, and those individuals that come into our businesses has created an atmosphere where there is certainly an undue suspicion that has been cast upon the entire Muslim community.
Audio from New York One. While advocates continue the legal challenge in New York, groups in San Francisco are praising the city's adoption of a new law that requires the police department to adhere to local and state civil rights standards when working with the FBI on its Joint Terrorism Task Force, or JTTF. Backers of the Safe San Francisco Ordinance say it is the first law in the country attempting to balance civil liberties and public safety concerns. FSRN's Max Pringle reports.
Since September 11, 2001, many Muslim Americans and immigrants say that law enforcement has unfairly put them under a microscope as a potential security risk. For example, the New York Police Department spied on that city's Muslim community, particularly student groups and mosques. And FBI agents in San Francisco spied on several Northern California mosques between 2004 and 2008 under the guise of community outreach. That's according to research from the ACLU. The group's report says FBI personnel gathered and stored names and addresses of local Muslims and shared the information with other law enforcement agencies, all without any evidence or suspicion of criminality. San Francisco's new policy aims to prevent these civil rights violations. Yemeni-American activist Mukhtar Al-Hansali says the Safe San Francisco Ordinance has made him and members of his community feel more welcome in their city.
It doesn't matter how many pat-downs, wire checks, GPS tracking devices. These things are not going to make us safe. What's going to make us safe is that community members are coming together like they are today and working together side by side. And I'm very proud and thankful that I've been a part of this community.
Nearly 80 community organizations and city agencies formed the San Francisco Safety Coalition back in 2010 to address civil rights concerns while also focusing on public safety.
We have members of our Muslim, South Asian, Arabic community that are scared, frankly, to work with SFPD, to work with any public safety agency, because they're worried that they'll be investigated simply because of their religious belief or their skin color.
San Francisco Supervisor Jane Kim authored the Safe San Francisco Ordinance with input from the community. She says it took some time to get buy-in from all concerned parties on how best to deal with how the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force affects Muslim Americans.
That was part of the learning processes for us to understand from SFPD's perspective how important their access to security information was and their concerns about if they didn't follow what the FBI had wanted, whether they would be able to access that level of information. And I think this compromise legislation tries to straddle that line.
Critics argue that the compromise legislation is too vague about the privacy assurances afforded to law-abiding citizens. Under the Joint Terrorism Task Force Memorandum of Understanding, or MOU, the FBI and local law enforcement share information on security threats and cooperate in other areas. But San Francisco Police Chief Greg Suhr says the department doesn't gather intelligence or conduct surveillance. He says the new law fills in the civil liberties holes in the FBI's version of the JTTF.
I think our biggest concern up front was that it was being suggested that we didn't extend the courtesy to everyone and respect everybody's standing, and we absolutely do, and I think it's great that that was mentioned up here, that this wasn't about the San Francisco Police Department not being in bounds or not doing what we were supposed to be doing.
Chief Suhr says the best public safety tools for any police department are eyes and ears in the community, and that, he says, means building trust.
Information is the life's blood of safety, and if anybody feels that they can't reach out, it just keeps us less safe.
Many groups have worked for years to fight negative preconceptions of Arabs and Muslims, including the San Francisco Arab Cultural and Community Center, a member organization of the Safe San Francisco Coalition. The group's president, Fuad Ateya, says the ordinance is a big step in the right direction.
Many of the organizations and individuals that are working with the coalition are not new to these issues. Our community have faced many difficult issues regarding our place in the city for many decades. Each of us has tried to work to bring understanding, knowledge, and representation of our community.
Other groups are also supportive of the new policy. Hyunju Ro is executive director of the Asian Law Caucus. She says San Francisco has earned a reputation worldwide as a destination for those seeking refuge from persecution, and this law confirms that.
What it also confirms is that there is a willingness here for our government leaders to work hand in hand with community folks, to listen to what communities are afraid of, to hear what they need, and to make sure that the government is responding.
Members of San Francisco's Safety Coalition will be branching out across the city over the next few months to promote the Safe San Francisco Ordinance and inform residents about their rights under the law. Max Pringle, FSRN, San Francisco.
This election season, tune into FSRN for thoughtful political coverage that prioritizes the public interest.
Voting rights are under attack in America.
A budget is a moral document that shows our nation's priorities and our values.
At FSRN, we go beyond the horse race and investigate the influence of lobbyists, super PACs, and tax-dodging corporations on your rights at home, abroad, and at the ballot box. And we bring you the voices of third-party candidates who are largely shut out of the two-party system.
When you deliberately devise a campaign that depends on a large number of small transactions, it needs exposure.
Visit our website, fsrn.org, to keep independent political reporting on the air. That's fsrn.org.
Many in New Orleans continue to fight the expected downsizing of the Times-Picayune to printing just 3 days a week. The legislature unanimously passed a resolution this week calling for the Times-Picayune to continue as a daily, and some in the city have mobilized a campaign to push the paper's owners to print or sell. FSRN's Zoe Sullivan spoke with New Orleans residents about the situation.
The Times-Picayune has 175 years of history. Some of its famous writers include William Faulkner and O. Henry. The paper also employed female journalists, including the poet known as Pearl Rivers, who became publisher in the 1870s. Fast forward to the last decade, when staff remained in the city during Hurricane Katrina and its deadly aftermath. The paper's breaking news coverage was honored with a Pulitzer Prize. But circulation has dwindled since Katrina, even though, according to Forbes, more than 75% of the city sees the paper each week. The paper is not without critics. Some point out that another news outlet, The Nation, first broke the story of homicidal police officers in Katrina's wake. Many progressives also consider it a mouthpiece for the more conservative elite in the city. In spite of this, many New Orleanians want the paper to stay. Outside a grocery store near the University of New Orleans, resident David Johnson reacted to the news that the city's daily paper was scaling back.
In a city like this, it's very low tech. I think going down to 3 days a week is a disservice. Large numbers of people here don't have internet. Large numbers of people are elderly. Large numbers of people are poor. So I do think that's a disservice and very harmful to our larger democratic functions. But as for me, I have to admit, I get mine on the web.
According to federal data compiled by the Investigative Reporting Workshop, between 40 and 60% of Orleans Parish residents lack broadband internet. In some poor neighborhoods, that drops to between 0 and 20%. For those who rely on the paper as their news source, its downsizing means less access to information. In addition to launching Save the Picayune social media campaigns, the paper supporters recently held a tailgate rally in front of a local bowling alley and dance hall. Michael Tisserand addressed the crowd at the start of the event.
We lead the way in music. We lead the way in food. We do not need to lead the way in being the only major city without a daily newspaper. And if anybody tells you that this is a story about the death of newspapers and the inevitable march online, it's not true. It's a false story. This is not the dying romance of print media. This is about one man trying to have an economic model, playing with New Orleans and playing with this community to see if he can make more money on his business.
Another organizer of the event is Ann Rolfes, who runs the environmental justice organization, the Louisiana Bucket Brigade. Despite her critiques of the paper's coverage, she says it still serves a critical function in the city.
We feel like the paper doesn't speak up enough for the people, doesn't speak up enough, for example, about the impacts of the BP oil disaster. And yet, if we don't have a paper, we have nobody paying attention to these companies that are really wreaking havoc in this state. And so we got to have it. You know, it's an accountability mechanism.
This isn't the first city where Advance Publications, owned by the Newhouse family, has adopted a primarily online model. In 2009, it dropped Michigan's Ann Arbor News to printing 2 days a week and shifted focus to AnnArbor.com. The company also announced recently that it's downsizing dailies in three Alabama cities, Huntsville, Birmingham, and Mobile, which will also publish 3 days a week. Picayune employees told FSRN that they expect to learn next week whether the paper will downsize the staff, and if so, how much. Zoe Sullivan, FSRN, New Orleans.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.